Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Professor Mark Garofoli. He is the Director of Experiential Learning and Clinical Assistant Professor at West Virginia University. He's actively involved in patient care and policy at West Virginia University Integrative Pain Management Center. And he is the host of the Pain Pod on the Pharmacy Podcast Network. And with that, I'd like to welcome.
Well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure, actually, since I'm making a return visit now, I guess. But always good to have conversations about some of these polarized, sensational, and just hot topics these days, right?
Exactly. Well, if anybody is the right person to talk to, it would be you about these issues. So let's jump right into it. President Biden issued a mass pardon for those with federal convictions for simple possession and use of marijuana. He also requested the government to reschedule marijuana as something other than a Schedule I drug. What are the implications of this move for the marijuana using community, both medically and recreationally, and at large for the medical community?
So it's another step in a direction where the ball has been rolling for a good while now, really. And what I mean by that in a bigger picture is the sentiment across our country with more than three quarters of our states having some sort of movement legally when it comes to cannabis, marijuana, CBD, the whole gamut. The majority of states now have something, whether it's medical, recreational, so on and so forth, as far as laws enacted. But this move recently by the President Biden administration, of course, caught some big headlines. I know I shared some stuff even on LinkedIn, as I usually do. And, just to get people thinking, is this a huge, pivotal, life-changing move? Well, in the gamut, on the surface, not really. Perhaps the intention is just to continue the ball rolling, maybe get it a little bit faster along the way. I find it interesting that when we see headlines across the country and to the tune of thousands of people pardoned, it catches all of our eyes and ears. We're all human. It caught mine originally as well, too. But when you think about it, there's 330 million Americans out there, and 6,500 is a rather low number. We've encountered this in numerous public health efforts in the last couple of years and really forever enduring. So it's in the big picture on the federal level, it's not necessarily a lot of people. But the intention, I believe, as our president had mentioned, was to provoke state governors to do the same at the state level. And that's really where we'd be adding zeros on to the number of Americans, with those types of pardons. Couple notes on that. Pardon is different from, just taking something completely off of one's record with no history whatsoever in the minute picture. One thing I've had a couple other folks in the realm bring up and have conversations with too is it's interesting that on the federal level, for someone in the past to have gotten a federal level marijuana possession penalty. A lot of times I cannot and will not put a number on it or a percentage. A lot of times they were up to something else much bigger. And that's what was agreed upon to, have something on the books per se. I find that rather interesting as well, because it's like, well, what else was going on if that was the only thing that was held there? The dangling fruit, I guess. So trying to talk about all sides here. This is one of those topics that everybody's got their personal facts. That's what one of my sisters-in-law calls opinions, by the way, personal facts. We've all got it. just trying to talk about all sides here, though, because there's a lot going on, to your point.
I think it's important to emphasize that because there's a few angles here. There's the conceptual angle, Freudian slip, on the harm reduction versus some of the more traditional policies on drug restriction and drug use. There's also the economic and social implications of marijuana and cannabis as medication, as a form of recreation, and how it entails use relative to other medications like prescription opioids or prescription benzodiazepines. So maybe let's kind of piece it one by one and kind of go through it, because I think each one is important to mention. So let's start with the most simple one. So the implication for medical and recreational marijuana dispensaries, what will this pardon now have in terms of changing business life and personal life for those functions?
Well, not to be overly succinct, but not much really. If you think about it, there's the call for the more conversation on rescheduling. Well, what does a controlled substance 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 or beyond even have to do with a medical or even recreational marijuana dispensary? I mean, absolutely nothing. They can't even use terminology like prescribe, dispense. It's just use different words and call it a day, really. But that has nothing really to do in that realm with these dispensaries. Now, when you go one more step, think about, I don't want to like name other necessarily federal entities, but like ATF, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. For this conversation, the F word in that one is irrelevant, casually related perhaps, but the alcohol and the tobacco, that they're kind of like on their own little island. They get an entire, another federal entity that has nothing to do with controlled substances. I usually use that example just to provoke people, that have that thinking of, well, in healthcare, we pivot around controlled substances, but turns out the rest of the world has a lot more going on too.
Well, let's touch on that. So if the dispensary component is a moot argument in this, let's focus on the more cognitive argument that marijuana plays in the overall role of harm reduction versus substituting a more dangerous, quote unquote, drug for a less dangerous, quote unquote, drug in the context of alcohol, tobacco, and prescription medications like opioids and benzodiazepines. So just cutting straight to the point here, is this now going to make marijuana a viable alternative to certain prescription medications that are deemed to be of high risk of abuse?
Well, if that's not the money question of the century, good golly. you use some pretty important quotes there when you're articulating that question there, of course. So, but where I'm going with that is, I'll take the heat off us here.
Yeah.
Dr. Nora Volkow, head of NIDA. Incredibly intelligent professional. I actually got to chat with her a little bit at the recent RX Summit in Atlanta, conference typically every April. Certainly implore folks to check that conference out. We had, as you mentioned, being the host of the Pain Pod, we were actually the podcast covering the conference overall. But anyways, myself and others, of course, got to chat with her a little bit. One thing that she cannot reiterate enough whenever having a microphone is, it's not all about what us in healthcare think about when it comes to a substance, a chemical, a medication. Access becomes a huge thing. In fact, it's probably the most important thing. To your point of asking the question of are there substitutions happening here, whether you're talking about prescription opioids, alcohol, benzos, whether illicit or even within the healthcare chain of prescription benzos, or cannabinoids or cannabis. We in healthcare, we tend to jump to, especially as a pharmacist, I'm always like, how does it work? Mechanism of action and how much? It's all about the dosage, baby. Those two things dictate safety, efficacy, all the rest of the stuff, drug interactions, all that important stuff that we unpack for our patients. But in the big picture, for society as a whole, it's really just, can you get your hands on it easily or not? And you can think about that with, we're here primarily talking about all things cannabis, but think about alcohol. It's responsible for as many related deaths in our country as all drugs, quote unquote, combined. Whereas tobacco is 5 times that. It's like 500,000 related. It's, indirect or direct related deaths a year. And it's something that, anybody as an adult can buy pretty much anywhere. That really drives home that access thing. So the whole war on drugs, the opioid crisis, the, whatever terminology we're appropriately using, of course, it really comes down to everything we know as healthcare folks, but then also the access. And finally, the court of public opinion. I really, I never really like to share opinions because I always pontificate about, but I really don't think it's an opinion anymore to think that the ship has sailed, that the American, court of public opinion has already said, okay, we're okay with this stuff that we'll refer to as cannabis everything. We see that in the laws I mentioned earlier, all across our country. The public opinion, certainly not all of us, not everyone, but the majority of America has already said, we're okay with access to this stuff. That doesn't mean that there'll be 100% good effects coming from that. We see that with alcohol and tobacco. I already talked about that, of course. But that final piece is public opinion. And that really that dominates the lands these days. It been silenced or submerged for a little while or changed, but that's really coming to the forefront now. And it's really important to keep in mind too. It's when folks are in the I always say like the play or movie, I guess, Hamilton, the room where it happens. When leaders, when community members are in the room where it happens and are making these decisions that affect so many people in our communities across the country. The opinions are already out there, and we have to be cognizant of that too. You mentioned harm reduction. Like perhaps there's, at the point of saying, all right, the ship is sailing. So how do we go about that in a way of reducing or preventing any harm here or there, regardless of, child, adult, elderly, whatever. We really have to take those big picture things into account.
I like the way you phrased it, and I'm just going to review it because I think it's important to summarize it. You talk about the actual pharmacological dangers of certain medications. As you mentioned, it's all about the dosage, baby. That's one thing that you've known for reiterating on your educational podcast. You talk about access, and then you talk about public opinion, and you're almost triangulating public policy, individual patient risk, and overall social implications, the moralizations, if you will, of the medications or of the drug into this pot where everything is mixed together, pun intended.
I
Let's go at
completely.
it,
I was going to
right?
call you out too.
Yeah, pun intended. But what's very interesting about that is then you can't help but create these false equivalencies then because it's very subjective. So almost in a way, you're saying access relative to danger relative to public opinion relative to. So it's almost inevitable that you're going to create these false equivalencies where a change in drug X or substance X is going to change my opinion of drug Y, a substance Y. And do we really want to go down that path? Because I see hesitation going that way because you can really lead to some pretty erroneous logic if you think that way.
Oh yeah, and if whatever the thought, or opinion, or whatever is, there's an article out there to back you up these days. Oh gosh, I think I said it the other day that the movie that the whole truth and nothing but the truth, or you can't handle the truth. I think that's actually two movies, but anyway, it's whatever one's truth is. There's articles out there, even in reputable journals, to back one up, and maybe that's okay too, by the way. There's a lot of thoughts out there, and we got to have the information, but we want to have everybody have it. You can't make an informed decision without information, quite frankly. I mean, that's what it boils down to. So.
So what is next then? Will marijuana become part of medical care more than it is now? Instead of being kind of relegated to fringe marijuana cards or recreational use, will we start to see marijuana now used as a viable prescription for medical conditions outside of
So,
the glaucoma and the traditional what have yous?
so utilizing a term like easily integrated into our healthcare system, saying prescription or prescribing dispensing, it might be a bit for that, if ever, but it might be a bit for that. That being said, that triangulation that we were talking about, and you thankfully summarized there, that really comes into play even on the healthcare side. If you think about it, we already have readily available FDA-approved cannabinoids in our country. Now, two-thirds of them cost more than an arm and a leg. I mean, there's very sadly, there's pediatric patients out there. There's kids out there having dozens of seizures a day. And you know what's helping them? CBD, the FDA-approved version, of course. But when you think about the cost of it, it's well into five figures compared to what somebody could acquire in their town in a building with a nice shiny neon sign for what some might say is expensive, but pennies compared to the product I just talked about.
Exactly.
And, you know, THC, there's been Marinol, Dronabinol for decades now. Cost is certainly different in that realm. And there's more and more in the pipeline. It is physically impossible to talk about, to talk without puns in this genre.
It seems like it, right?
you don't even have to think about it. But anyways, there's all that. You know, folks will say, oh, what, you know, what's Big Pharma up to? Like if it's this big cartoon figure or something. Well, they're developing like every other medical condition and every other type of substance, medication, whatever. There's cannabinoids that are aiming to be prescription products in the pipeline, just like everything else. Because it's a relatively newer frontier. The concept of the endocannabinoid system, or ECS, it sounds like another language or something. You know, a very out there question, be like, why don't we teach about that in health class? I'm talking like seventh and eighth grade. Like, how would I make it this far in life with learning that in my more recent decades? There's a body system, like polarity out of it. It's something that's in there. Just like we have endorphins, you know, endogenous opioids in our body too. It's less provocative these days, but you think 20, 30 years ago and be like, ooh, where are they going with this? It's just getting that information out there really. Those some of the things that are really coming into play, especially on the healthcare side. But here and now today, all across our country, I've observed this with so many clinicians, even of that whole access and public opinion thing. Sometimes folks, you know, like think about an ER. What if somebody brings a quote unquote medical marijuana into an ER? Is that okay with that healthcare system, with that hospital system? Well, policies are being developed and have already been developed of what do you do? Do you allow it? Well, if you don't allow it, then what do you do?
Yeah.
I mean, physically, like with your hands and with your patient counseling and all that, like, is there going to be a law enforcement in every room or something? Like, what do you do? The practicality, you know, if we make the triangle a square, I guess. it's very tricky when you think about it. And I have observed where, you know, people are like, oh, of course, not in our house. And then you kind of go down that path. And about 3 days later, you're like, okay, well,
yeah.
What are we going to do?
You know, it's so funny you mentioned that because there's this kind of schism in the minds of so many healthcare professionals about broad policy and how it applies individually. Everybody mm-hmm. always says, I support harm reduction. This is permissible, so on and so forth. But as long as it's not in my backyard. Yeah. And then when that happens, all of a sudden you start to develop these different modes of thinking. And it's funny because it's very difficult to predict how healthcare will react to this because there's inevitably going to be a strong mm-hmm. reaction for or a strong reaction against. And what signals are you seeing? Is this going to be a strong for or a strong against?
That's a tough prediction, yeah. for the cloud that we call our healthcare society. You know, integrated within healthcare, as all of us healthcare professionals, it's folks that have had experiences out in the community as well, too. You know, every holiday dinner, even let's take it away from work within a healthcare setting. You know, you got Uncle so-and-so and Aunt so-and-so pontificating every holiday dinner. Sooner or later, like things start catching on and all that. And we start to be thinking like, okay, well, you know, like bigger conversations of, oh, is there efficacy in various medical conditions for various cannabinoids or cannabis? I mean, there's a lot of studies out there already. There's review articles. I think it was 2-3 years ago, of all things, the American Heart Association had a review article. I'm a little foggy on the origin there, but anyways, it really good stuff as far as reviewing the, hey, this information is actually, you could, you know, trust this in clinical care, or this stuff, studies aren't really showing, you know, strength to follow these things. And there's, of course, been subsequent reviews as well, too. But there is a lot of information out there. Kind of piggybacking on what I mentioned earlier, there's already FDA-approved products.
Yeah.
You know, are the right drums being banged for what people are looking to articulate?
Yeah.
It's, there's only certain urination contests you want to enter and actually have a SMART goal, something attainable. That's the A, of course. And I'm sure you value your time. That's the T, to quote unquote win. So,
it's amazing how there's such an air of ambiguity around all of this. And it's funny because we see an announcement, it makes headline news, and the political machinations go into motion, President Biden, so on and so forth, collects his accolades. And then there's always this, so what, or what's next moment. And inevitably, everybody's always wondering, is this now a bellwether to increase access to all forms of medications that have potential abuse potential? Or is this a bellwether to say, because we increase access to marijuana and various cannabinoids, we will reflexively decrease access to other forms of medication, a la opioids and benzodiazepines? We don't know how to look at this. But the question would be then, who would be the tells? How would we know which direction federal policy, health policy leaders are going? Where are the tells, and who would be revealing them?
That's another tough one there. So almost converse to that, really. I guess you'd call it a grassroots. I'm kind of like a grassroots thinker in this regard, in that no matter what the policy, the law, the large scale, the 50,000 foot view in the trees, whether it involves like literally being locked up, criminal record, whatever, or whatever policies, even within healthcare, it comes down to those individual human interactions and decisions. There's multiple instances of this, of very polar topics in our country and quite frankly our globe, where even if it's the majority thinking something, is that what's good for every single individual? Perhaps it's public health compared to, I won't pit them against each other, but public health compared to patient care.
There's
obviously a difference, and both involve very intelligent professionals, hundreds of thousands of them, if not millions, actually, across our country. So, to your point, like, who's right? Every single conversation, I hope, except this one, but it ends up being you're running around in a circle. I mean, every high school's got them these days, of, the track. You go and you run, like, where the heck are you actually getting? You're getting back to square one and you wasted an hour of your time. I hope it doesn't take everybody an hour to get around the track. But anyway, we've all had those types of conversations, whether you see it coming or not, really. And it's because we're talking about such things, like you mentioned, like, okay, there's harm reduction, there's access to the substances, whatever be it. There's efficacy, there's the safety concerns, there's policy overall. And there's not really a common ground for overlap amongst them.
Yeah.
Everything always gets pitted against each other. Like, oh, there has to be one. There's got to be a solution. I'd take heat for this, but it's like, there's a solution to the opioid crisis. If there was a solution, wouldn't somebody have stumbled upon it like 3,000 years ago?
Seriously.
Back when we were along the Nile only, solutions are actions by us humans being there to help each other, or at least even ourselves, quite frankly. And that's really where a lot of this comes down to. It is creating either public policy, laws, whatever, being different than what you hope for and expect of someone, or to talk through them. It's almost borderline talking about parenting here. I feel like my kids should be in the room, but guiding people. There's a difference between you can't do that, you will get locked up, and saying, hey, if you do that, something bad might happen, comma, but we'll be there for you anyway, because you're a human, you have a heartbeat. That might be a low-key or a very provocative last statement there, but depending on how deep somebody reads into it. But there's a lot going on, and everything ends up, it's not like there's a common ground for everything. And we have to keep that in mind, where there's not going to be a solution to it. It's a whole bunch of action as solutions. And to do it on a macro level is so hard that I don't know if that's a SMART goal. Yet we want to do something, right?
Yeah. I would agree with that sentiment, that the start of a solution cannot happen at a macro level, because there's just too much polarization and organizational infrastructure to overcome. My question Really, and this is another kind of open-ended, broad question with no real answer. And I think it says something about this conversation that we keep running into questions with no definitive answer. Why aren't we comfortable with uncertainty? As a pharmacist, if you encounter uncertainty, you have a way of thinking through it. As a clinician, when we encounter uncertainty, we have a way of thinking through it. But for this issue, the premise of uncertainty is not acceptable. We have to have a side, and both sides have to be pit against one another, and we have to fight. What is it about uncertainty that we struggle with when it comes to these issues?
And one of my least favorite, if not the least favorite forms of leadership is micromanagement. And I know that the vast majority of anyone listening, not all, but the vast majority would agree with that. But there are folks that do like it, whether you're the leader or being led, by the way. We do struggle with that, with the concept of just being torn in the, like, we want to know what to do every single time. And interestingly enough, like if you travel around the globe, even in healthcare systems, when there's less resources, things get more prescriptive. For instance, I was just talking. We had some student pharmacists and pharmacists travel to South Africa. Certainly, a different atmosphere in the area. A lot of patients with HIV and TB. Now, especially in the latter part there with TB, we certainly see less of that here in our country. But when and if it happens, you're probably going to have the best of the best minds figuring it out along the way. Whereas in that country, it's prescriptive. Okay, somebody has TB. This is exactly what we use. Next patient. And there's a comfort level with that, actually, humanistically. And by the way, they're helping the patient. But we would spend lots of time not being used to the scenario, debating back and forth and quoting JAMA and New England Journal from 30 years ago. It's we really we might not want to admit it. I don't even want to admit it, actually. We don't want to admit liking that, but that's what we do. We debate, we talk through things in a very good way too. But having a cookie cutter answer to a very complicated, well beyond healthcare, well beyond society in itself. Every layer of society is involved in this kind of stuff. Having cookie cutters, just it's not going to work out for 330 million people, nor the billion across the globe as well too. But maybe in certain sectors, just like that country example of, maybe colloquially it'll work out. But will it work out for the entirety of humanity is a whole nother question. So.
Well, I would agree with you, and I think most people would agree with you. But the issue then becomes, well, if we were to extrapolate that line of logic into a solution, you're essentially advocating for individualized care. Which who can argue against that? But all of a sudden that leads to decisions that are not, as you mentioned, prescriptive, meaning they're not routine or set based on certain parameters of thinking. Is it that we have too many hands in the stove, too many cooks in the kitchen, that we need to maybe have some individuals, some organizations take a step back and say, we no longer need your input into this conversation.
I don't know about that. It would make things more streamlined, but personally, at least, I'm all about the interprofessionalism and I mean, well beyond healthcare too, like involving law enforcement in various decisions, all throughout society, even religious leaders and given communities. It's having more, folks at the table. It's typically a good thing. However, redefining what the goal is paramount for any meeting. I mean, why have a meeting if you're not going to have action? And then you end up having meetings about meetings. But what is the actual goal is really important. And is it a smart goal? Is it something actually attainable? Does it apply to, perhaps one entity or one meeting might be having too many people, as you mentioned. If the goal is very micro, how many outside folks do you really need? Repetitively, of course. But if you're, it's like within healthcare, we have guidelines galore, and somehow they get transcribed into, hard limits on things. And it's like there's a significant difference between a threshold and a limit. Threshold is like, hey, we're entering not necessarily a danger zone here. It's not Top Gun, but but you're entering an area of more scrutiny as compared to a hard limit. We see that in a lot of pain management efforts as well too, but guidelines in general, it is a guide. Pigs live, hogs die. You don't always want to be the statistical outlier, but every now and then we're dealing with humans. Every now and then, that's understandable. And that's tough when you're talking about these macro policies, across a country, even of understanding that, like, hey, there's going to be, every rule has its exceptions, I've learned in life, not just one.
Yeah.
And how do we mitigate those? Having contingency plans, it seems like a frontier where we haven't gone to yet. Other than, okay, if something's illegal, this is what we do. Well, what else is there? It's been a while. We've got some experience in that realm. What else? Like in this realm of folks, going back to the headlines, of course, with the pardonings and all that. It's like, well, what else is there to not ruin someone's record and affect their job opportunities for the rest of their lives? It's been decades. Like, there's got to be other things to think about along the way. And the more folks at the table, the more kind of off the wall brainstorming ideas you can have. A whole lot of ideas that probably aren't helpful too, but take with the good, with the bad. But at some point you do have to cut that depending on what the actual goal is. And that comes down to leadership to define what is our goal? What's the purpose here for any meeting or organization or whatever?
I like that because we have to come to terms with the fact that we're not going to find a solution in the near term. A solution is very much a work in progress. But we can at least start on the right foot. And I want to leave with this question to you, because I think that it'll end on a positive note and really emphasize a lot of your work, both individually and at policy level. How do we start having this conversation with clinicians, pharmacists, law enforcement, social leaders? How do we start this conversation?
That's actually an easy one. Listening.
Yeah.
We see this, you get all the folks you just mentioned. If you put them in a room, everybody's walking in with a different experience. I'd add EMTs into there.
Yeah.
If you're talking to a healthcare professional, you pick any of us here, I'll use pharmacists as myself, of course. My experience in a pharmacy or in a hospital clinic, whatever, is going to be fundamentally and profoundly different than someone who arrives on the scene of deaths every day. It's just inherently going to be different. Think of like if it's opioid overdoses, so naloxone, the experiences are just going to be fundamentally and profoundly different. And both of us would need to listen to each other to be able to even start. I have to recognize that. Law enforcement right along the same lines. And by golly, of course, even within healthcare of, whether it's prescriber, dispenser, all of the folks along the way, it honestly, just starting with a little bit of a listening session, keeping it simple.
Nice. And for those who are planning or considering to start such a listening session or a community forum, what are some resources or some informational packets that they can reference to help coordinate all of this and make it as effective as possible?
That's a very good question, actually. So, at the bigger picture level, even across our country, I've heard there may be some name changes in the future, but SAMHSA in this realm having a plethora out there. A lot of resources are going to send people to the very big level, though, and hopefully navigate to the local level. I would really implore everybody to just think differently and start local and little. It's amazing what the smallest conversations can do. It can be organized or not. I mean, community events happen. Just start chatting with other parents that are out there, start chatting with, kids, teachers or whatever. You never know when you find somebody with a little spark, and then all of a sudden you are having community meetings. I'd really recommend it. The resources are out there. Of course, I think we mentioned a few, but it's really about just starting those conversations and listening throughout them, of course, too.